Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. My guest this evening is Judy Gruen, who's an award-winning humor columnist. She's published 4 books, including her latest one, Till We Eat Again, A Second Helping. She has been anthologized in more than 10 books. She writes both laugh out loud funny essays as well as serious features, which appear regularly in Age.com and other media outlets. Her latest book, Till We Eat Again, is a true chronicle of her efforts to lose a measly 15 pounds in time for a college reunion, and it's getting rave reviews. Her humorous writings deal not just with the funny side of losing weight, but on her website, judygruen.com, in the section of My Noodle, you will also find how should I say the subtle absurdities encountered in everyday life. Good evening, Judy.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
My pleasure. So how did you get into the business of funny writing? When did you first find out that you had a great sense of humor and that others would appreciate it?
Well, I'm not sure. I think I inherited it from my paternal grandfather. He was a real jokester, and I always looked at the funny side of things. I remember as a small child, there were televangelists were beginning to be on TV, and some of them were just so outrageously exaggerated in everything they did. I watched it, and I started imitating one or two of them, and of course I cracked up my mother. Well, if you can't crack up your own mother, who can you? That was not a great it didn't tell me at that time, oh yeah, you should try and make people laugh for a living. It's not an easy thing to do, but I was always a writer. I always knew that I would write, and when I think back on it, the very first freelance essay that I ever published and sold to a real newspaper when I was in my early 20s was about the same theme that I can't seem to escape from, and that was about the odyssey of trying to lose weight, stay slim. That essay was called Fear of Fat, Don't Let It Make You Skinny. I was very excited to get that published in a real newspaper. And I've always just done it as a sideline. I actually have a background in healthcare writing, healthcare reporting, and healthcare media relations. So laughter is the best medicine, and I've always maintained a very strong strong interest in writing about health issues and a very strong interest in trying to make people laugh to help get perspective so that we don't take ourselves too seriously. And just as a healthy endorphin-releasing exercise.
In your book, your current book, Till We Eat Again, there are some very, very funny passages, especially when you try to describe all the various methods you use to lose weight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, was that really the way it happened, or was there lots of exaggeration?
You know, I didn't have to exaggerate. I'm sure you've heard, and your audience has heard the expression that truth is stranger than fiction. It's really true, and truth is often funnier than fiction. Just so that your audience knows, Until We Eat Again, A Second Helping, it is a real diary that I kept over the course of about a year in which I was trying to, as you said, try and lose 15, quote, measly pounds in time for a college reunion. And I live in Los Angeles, so there are many, many things available to me in terms of different kinds of gyms. So I did everything from going to a regular gym and Pilates, but I also tried things like fitness boot camp and belly dancing and Bikram yoga, which is essentially yoga done in a room where the temperature has been set to broil, and all kinds of things. And believe me, I could not have made it up. I went and I tried different things. Yes, I tried to to see if I would like it. I also knew there would be humorous things going on. I was in one yoga class, and I was trying so hard to get the positions right and watching the instructor, and she came over to me, and she sort of whispered, this is not interpretive dance. And then she tried to correct my form. So I don't need to exaggerate. It's just all there. All I do is pay attention and write it down.
Well, looking at some of the trainers that you had, I mean, these guys are, however they don't try to be, they're extremely funny, extremely hilarious.
They really are.
The way they hold themselves so seriously, you know, almost like they're the repository of every truth about the weight loss. And only they know the right way and nobody else, and the way they act and everything. I mean, it's...
Right. One of the things that drives me crazy and sure drives other people crazy, and which I wrote about in Till We Eat Again, A Second Helping, is that there's so much contradictory advice. For example, I did this boot camp, fitness boot camp. It met six in the morning or six in the evening. Neither were very family-friendly times for me as a mother of four, but I did it. And the major, he had been a major in the Air Force or something, made us get on the scale all the time. I just hated that. But by the end of the whole session where we had our little awards ceremony and I had lost whatever few pounds I had lost, but I had really felt a lot better. I was definitely in better shape. You try working out with an Army major and you'll get in better shape too, believe me. And I said to him, I said, but gee, Major, you know, I only lost 5 pounds or whatever it was. He says, oh, it doesn't matter what the scale says. It's how your clothes fit and how you feel. Well, now he told me. Meanwhile, every time I showed up, he made me get on that scale. So it's those kinds of things that are everywhere. The gym that I go to now, everybody is, of course, impossibly fit. Well, the instructors anyway, but they have Buddha statues everywhere. That just cracks me up. You know, Buddha with a big swag belly, he doesn't look like he's been doing too many downward dogs recently. So the amusing things are everywhere. And again, it was not a matter of having to make things up or exaggerate. It was just a matter of just keeping my eyes open with my journalistic background and writing it down. And the truth speaks for itself, and often it speaks in very funny ways.
Well, what have you learned about most of the claims that all these methods for weight loss have? What have you learned about the truth or untruth of them?
Well, we still see advertisements for all kinds of crazy things. You know, one thing that I added to the manuscript almost at the last minute, because it was a new kind of ad that I started seeing everywhere, was strange fruit burns fat. You may have seen it, you know, when
right.
you're online.
Absolutely.
Strange. Well, what kind of strange fruit? Is it a papaya? Is it a mango? Oh, no, it's a mango. It has to come from Africa. It has to come from this forest in Africa. So one thing that I learned, which I had already really known, but it really impressed itself upon me more, is if something sounds too good to be true or sounds too crazy, then it is too good to be true or it is crazy. We all have to tap back into the common sense that we all have and just know that we've got to eat more modest portions. We do have to move more. Many of us live much more sedentary lives because we work at computers. We it's a lot of it is just common sense. But there is something, there are some people out there who say that you got to eat by your blood type. I wrote about that and thought, oh, well, that's just great. You know, I've got four kids and a husband, and, you know, among us, we've got two or three different kind of blood type, so how am I supposed to cook for you according to your blood type? So
right.
I don't think that the Almighty intended to make things so very difficult for us. He gave us an extraordinary universe with a multiplicity of beautiful foods, fruits and vegetables that are beautiful to look at, and focusing on them, but of course not skimping on the heart-healthy dark chocolate, just because it's also good for us. More and more research shows that. In fact, on the homepage of my website, judygruen.com, scrolling down, I have a little bit of a blog there, and I've I write about the good news about chocolate that keeps just melting in. So what did I learn? Just be practical, use your common sense, eat as many fruits and vegetables, eat lower on the food chain. But you know, if somebody comes up to you and says, oh, I just gave up all white flour and sugar and I just feel great, you know, it's just be patient with them and learn to let that go. I believe in moderation, and I don't believe in giving up any particular food group, unless you're really addicted. There are some people who have a true sugar addiction, and that's definitely a serious thing.
I absolutely do. And I am at my ideal weight.
Oh, you absolutely do what? You have a sugar addiction?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
I hardly touch it anymore, but on Shabbos, I make up for everything I miss during the week.
Right. Well, thank goodness for Shabbos, where we can, you know, have a few more carbs. Unfortunately, I also learned that carb really is a four-letter word, especially as I get older. I have to say I am middle-aged now, and so it becomes that much harder to stay in the trim. But I learning to laugh, to get perspective, laugh at the funny things around us, that's mm-hmm. a very healthy way to live as well.
About 3 years ago, I felt I had to lose about 33 pounds. So I embarked on this horrible diet that had all types of powders with very enticing flavor names. However, if you were to offer me $1 million to tell you which one tasted the worst, I would have a very tough time.
Yes.
They were all horrible.
Right.
It was 1,200 calories a day.
Mm-hmm.
During the day, I could drink up to 7 of these powders. And mm-hmm. at the end of the day, I could have a salad with about 2.5 ounces of beef or cold cuts.
That's not very much for a grown man.
That's correct. It almost killed me. But I lost my weight. Then
uh-huh.
I went for another 9 weeks. I went on a secondary diet from the same group that basically would get me used to eating more things and so on and so forth. And it actually worked. Since then, I've been at my ideal weight. Granted, a man's metabolism is different than a woman's. We also do not obsess as much about the weight.
Right.
And I think that the obsession is one of the main problems.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is, and it's one reason why I think my book, Till We Eat Again, A Second Helping, resonates so much with women, although men are enjoying it too, because the culture around us is very toxic for women. Actually, right now I have a serious piece on H.com about Helen Gurley Brown, who just passed away,
mm-hmm.
and she
yes,
was the
I
editor.
I read it.
Yeah, and
of Cosmo.
Yeah, of Cosmo, and just the messages that women get is basically that we never look good enough, and that's, of course, not a Jewish concept at all. We're trying to build ourselves from the inside out and have a sense of inner beauty, but it's one reason that I wrote this book is because I know that I'm not the only woman who obsesses. I don't obsess nearly as much as I used to. I'm happily married for 25 years to a wonderful man who never minded that I carried a little more feather bedding than I would have liked, nothing too severe. And, you know, we just have to learn to accept ourselves and pay more attention to some of the more serious
right.
things in life. And if we have a good self-esteem that comes from who we are inside, I think a lot of the weight issues for a lot of people might resolve themselves.
Well, a lot of it has to do with the popular culture. In the 70s, in the 60s and 70s, all of a sudden, Twiggy became the ideal of what a woman should look like. In the classical days, in the Middle Ages, in the Renaissance, if you
mm-hmm.
look at the models that all the great painters used, Twiggy might have been used maybe as somebody just to clean up the studio floor. She would never
exactly.
have been
exactly.
a model.
Right. I actually wrote about that. One of my diary entries in the book is about one day when I just was just tired of everything that I was doing, and I went to the art museum, and I went and I mm-hmm. looked in and admired some of those Renaissance paintings where a woman, you know, who you could hug, actually, and not get splinters was an object of desire. But you're right, the messages that we get here are just awful. I mean, models who modeling the clothes, everything hangs on them. They all look miserable. Have you noticed this? You know, get this girl a hamburger with fries, because they all look miserable. And where and when that had to become, I don't know, the model of modeling is insane. And nobody should look like that. And they all smoke cigarettes just to keep
right.
the hunger at
to
bay.
It's
unhealthy. And they live train wreck lives. It's very sad, really.
In another lifetime, back in Arizona, I used to be a fashion photographer. So, yes, you're absolutely right about the models being very, very skinny. And it was my job, like every other fashion photographer, to make them look good.
Mm-hmm.
And we used all types of tricks in the laboratory. In those days, there was no digital photography.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often, you would never recognize the finished product, the finished photo, from the model that I had just finished shooting.
Exactly. Right, right. Well, again, you know, getting perspective and keeping in mind what really matters in life, including the perspective that we get from healthy doses of laughter, I think will help us all live longer, healthier, and happier lives. That's
absolutely
that's my opinion. And you know, some of the funny things that I also observed when I was doing everything I was doing, I was also trying different diet plans, and I was going to Weight Watcher meetings and all this sort of thing. You know, when you see a line in an ad that says "lose weight effortlessly," when I see those three words in the same sentence, I think it should be a form of hate speech. You know, and there's so many other funny things. In a fitness class, the teachers are barking so many instructions at you all the time, and it's actually a good workout for your brain to just try and process all the different instructions that you're getting, just to do one little move. Sometimes they say, "Remember to breathe," and then "abs tight." So sometimes I think, well, pick one, lady. You know, I had a big breakfast this morning. So it's either "remember to breathe" or "abs tight," but you're not getting both out of me right now. These are kind of some of the observations that I share in the book in the hope that it will spread the gift of laughter, which I think is so important.
Well, you, on December 7th, your entry for December 7th, you talk, for example, about a bathroom scale purchased at Target.
Yes.
And how apparently your husband took it away from you. And then you had to go away looking for a replacement.
Exactly.
What? Now, you did quite a bit of work finding the right replacement, but what were you looking for specifically when you were going for looking for a scale the second time? Why was not an exact copy of the first one good enough?
Well, the first one had become just a dust catcher, just in the same way that sometimes when people buy elliptical machines, it becomes just another hanger as opposed to a useful piece of exercise equipment. But
I use mine.
You use yours? Well, that's good. We're using ours more, too. I found a real company, and this is really its real name, Old Will Not Scales in Enid, Oklahoma, and their motto was "lowest dang prices anywhere." So it was such a charming and old-fashioned thing, you know. I called them and I said, "Well, you had me at dang." And they had so many models of scales, and they even had talking scales. So, you know, if my scale ever talked back to me, I'd have to take it out in the backyard and shoot it. So I definitely did not want a talking scale. Some scales actually didn't just talk to you. They joked about your weight. Now, I don't know who thought that was a good idea. I just went for a digital thing, again, because everything in our lives seems to be digital right now. Everything is a digital download, a digital this and a digital that. But I do confess that I really go more by how my clothes fit and how I feel and how I look than I don't hop on the scale. People talk a lot these days about reducing your carbon footprint. I say we have to reduce our naked footprint and not jump on the scale every morning. I know there are a lot of women who do that, and women have natural fluctuations in their weight that you know, are just not a big worry, and they can't help it. But I think if it adds stress to them getting on that scale too often, that will be counterproductive. So I ended up with another scale pretty much just like the one my husband took to work to get it away from me. He actually needed
After
it.
After all that.
Well, he needed it actually at work to weigh packages and such. At least that's what he told me.
Now, you talk about the BMI, the body mass index.
Yes.
Is that a real thing, or is that another thing that, you know?
No, that's a real
thing.
Those
who are looking
BMI,
for it, it's
no,
not
no,
a gimmick?
No, it's a real thing. It's body mass index, and a lot of people in the weight control industry and doctors and any people in the healthcare field are very familiar with it. It basically tries to measure how much of you is fat as opposed to muscle. And depending on the number you get on the BMI, and my score was not very favorable to me, I must say. And it was adding insult to injury. I went to a place to get the BMI tested, and of course it was some skinny little 20-year-old, you know, with calipers coming at me. And I thought, you know, I don't deserve this. But, you know, I let myself in for a lot of punishment while I was doing the book, but I think it all was for the good. I did lose weight. I did get in better shape. I did make some slow and some faster changes in how I cook for my family and how I eat. And I learned that when you, just in other areas of our lives, if we make changes that are slow and not drastic, they're far easier to cope with. You're far more likely to stick with it and to get healthier. And certainly, as much as I joke about it and as much as I'll never give up chocolate, I want to live as long as I can and as healthfully as I can as well, just like anybody else.
Now, even though you just told me that you absolutely accept the BMI as a real thing,
mm-hmm.
the description in your book goes something like, weight in kilograms divided by height in meters squared, multiplied by shoe size divided by number of shoes in your closet, squared by income tax bracket.
Well, okay, that part I did make up. But the BMI is a real thing. But because I'm not a math person, and the way that this skinny little woman who pinched me with calipers on that dreadful day, the way that she explained it to me, I found very confusing. So I figured, well, as long as I don't understand how they came to this figure, I'll just make up something that I think is funny. But I think many women in the audience who are listening to this program will be nodding in recognition. They know, they've heard of the BMI, and it's just something else that they have to just not worry about too much.
Yes,
you know,
and
the
I love your next paragraph where you said that the formula description was no help to you. My formal education, you say, did not prepare me for life in the metric system. However, I could also try to figure out my BMI the old-fashioned way. Weight in pounds divided by height in inches squared, multiplied by 703, multiplied by dress size, divided by number of recent parking tickets, squared by number of recently discovered endangered species. According to the government, a healthy BMI is supposed to be between 19 and 25. So I don't know how I came up with the number 42,598%, but math has never been my forte.
Well, I think that if I remember correctly, the number 703 is part of the calculation of the BMI, and the rest, of course, everybody will recognize I was just having fun. But it is true that according to the government, the BMI number is supposed to be somewhere between 19 and 25.
25, right.
Yeah. And mine was a little above that. I was not happy. It wasn't dramatically above it, but it was enough to make me feel that what I wanted to eat to comfort myself and what I should eat were two very different things.
But that's with everybody.
Right. To me, the idea of comfort food is a redundant phrase. You know, unless it's a jicama stick, of course food is going to be comforting.
Well, yes and no. There are certain foods that on certain times of the year you absolutely need. Like if you come in from a super cold day in the winter, snowy, icy day, there is nothing like a hot soup.
Absolutely.
It makes you feel completely different. Whereas the same hot soup during the summer, you would barely touch it.
Right, right. My kids have just been home for the summer. I have three sons and a daughter, and they're all in yeshiva or seminary. And they, you know, it's been very, very hot here in Los Angeles. And one Shabbos or two Shabboses ago, one of my sons asked about making cholent, and I just stared at him. Because it was so hot, I couldn't imagine anybody wanted cholent. And they said, hey, you know, it's Shabbos, we want cholent. Well, they didn't get it, but, you know, I know what you mean. There's nothing like a wonderful, nourishing, hearty soup. And food is more than food. it's more than
Absolutely.
The sum of its parts, right? It's nourishment,
Absolutely.
And it's love, and it's energy, and it's bracha, and it's so many things.
Various chefs have told me that you can taste the same exact recipe made by four different people at the same time in the same kitchen, and the final result will taste different in all four cases. Everybody used the same recipe exactly. Everybody used the same ingredients, the same amount of time, cooking, so on and so forth, but there are differences. What
Right.
are the differences? How much you love what you're doing.
Wow.
That's the secret ingredient. And that came from quite a few chefs, quite a few big names.
That's fascinating, but it doesn't surprise me at all. I think that you see that in there you're talking about something that you can literally taste the energy that somebody put into preparing food and how much
Right.
they cared about what
Right.
they were doing. I think that's fascinating. That's excellent.
Now, tell us a little bit about your other books.
My other books, okay. Well, Till We Eat Again, A Second Helping is either the fourth or the fifth book. I know I said my math is not great, but I can count to five. It is a revision of my second book, and the reason I'm making that point is because I really hope people go and buy it. It's available from Amazon.com in both softcover and Kindle. But the original version was called Till We Eat Again, Confessions of a Diet Dropout. I really wouldn't want anyone buying the old copies of that because this is an improved, revised, updated, redesigned, far superior edition. The book that I did within the last calendar year is a totally different book. It's a book on MBA admission strategies. It's called MBA Admissions for Smarties, The No-Nonsense Guide to Acceptance at Top Business Schools. And I co-wrote that with Linda Abraham because part of my career is doing graduate school admissions consulting, particularly for MBAs. My other humor book before that was called The Women's Daily Irony Supplement. That's also available. Both of these books, all these three books are available on Kindle and paperback. And what am I forgetting? Oh, my very first book was called Carpool Tunnel Syndrome, Motherhood as Shuttle Diplomacy. And there are some old copies of that floating around. And that was based on my adventures in motherhood, raising three sons and one daughter, all of whom have been described at one time or another as labadick.
Well, those kids are at some point are very labadick.
Yeah, and I do regular writing for H.com, for I've been on Metro Ema and the JewishWoman.org, which is the Chabad women's website, and
right.
wherever else I can insinuate my writing and share the work that I love, and I hope that my work is tasty for people too, because I know that I've always loved writing, and I still do all these decades later. It's something that you can never... You can never just sit back and say, okay, I've gotten to this level and I'm done. There's always room to grow. There's always room to see how much better you can make your work and how much livelier and how much more you can connect with an audience. And that's something that I just adore.
And we're almost out of time. Time has gone so fast. When you have a great guest, you barely notice the passage of time.
Well, thank you. I've been very, very blessed to have these opportunities. And again, I love my work. It sounds like you love your work as well. And
absolutely.
When you do, then it doesn't feel like work at all, does it?
Absolutely. It feels more like somebody is paying me for, going through FAO Schwartz's toy shop.
Oh, good old FAO Schwartz. There used to be one here in Los Angeles. It's gone now, but I have fond memories of going through there with my kids.
Yeah, right. I used to take my grandkids over there. The place was incredible.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, since we're running down the clock, I do invite readers to go to my website, judygruen.com, JudyGruen, and you can read my columns on the Off My Noodle page. There's also shorter blog entries on the homepage. And you could also download the first chapter of Till We Eat Again, A Second Helping, from my website. And if you like it, go get it. That's all I can
say. Actually, folks, I think you won't like it, you'll love it.
Oh, even better. I was trying to be modest. I guess I didn't do a very good job, huh?
Well, you can be modest, but I'm the outsider here, so I can tell you like it is.
Okay. All right, wonderful. I appreciate it so very, very much.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure having you on. We have to do this again.
I would love to. Thank you.
Okay, and thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Tune us in again next Wednesday at 8 o'clock Eastern Time. Thank you very much, one and all, and good night.